Okay, hello everyone. So you may have already heard about our work under the name RC4 No More, and which is the name we gave to one of the attacks I will about to present. And we did that to publicize the work a bit and to really try to tell people that you should no longer be using RC4. So first I'm going to give a quick background on RC4. It is a stream cipher, and its description is actually very simple and short, which makes it quite an intriguing algorithm for many people. It is used in various situations. For example, it is used to protect wireless networks, such as in the web and WPA TCAP protocol. It is also used in several cipher suites in SSL and TLS. And it is also used to protect certain end-to-end encryption protocols and in several other situations as well. So it is a stream cipher, which basically means you give it a key, it outputs a key stream. And encryption is, as you would expect, you simply XOR it with the plain text and you get the ciphertext. Now, the last few years, RC4 has received quite a lot of attention. There has been many attacks that have been published against RC4. And basically, the recommendation these days is to stop using RC4 because it is a bad cipher. So you may be wondering, do people still use RC4? And to answer that question, we look at data of the ICSI notary, and they are able to monitor a large number of TLS connections, and we can see that around the first time an attack against RC4 in TLS was published, almost half of all the TLS connections used RC4. If we fast forward 2 years, we see that this number is still around 30%, which is still very high. There is also a bit of a good news. If we look at the last few months, it has actually decreased by quite a lot. So that's good news. On the other hand, this 13% is, in my opinion, still quite high. Additionally, these statistics are actually not perfect because they do not take into account RC4 fallback. Now, what do I mean with RC4 fallback? Your browser, if you have a modern browser and it tries to connect to a HTTPS web server, it will initially say, I don't support RC4, so don't use it. And if you're connecting to a modern server, this is no problem. The server will select a decent algorithm and everything is fine. However, in case the server is badly configured or it's an old one, it will say, no, I really want to use RC4, so this handshake will fail. And what your browser does then, depending on its settings, but common these days, is that it will simply fall back to using RC4 again. And this does not actually provide any security because this handshake failed message can be forged by an attacker. However, this does pose a problem to us because this 13 estimate is actually only a lower bound if you take this into account. Because while 13% of connections use RC4, a number of these other connections can be attacked using this method, so they are also vulnerable to the attacks we will present. However, we have no idea how many connections are vulnerable, and that's the reason why this 13% is considered to be a lower bound on the number of connections that are vulnerable. Our goal of the paper is basically to really try to kill off RC4 and show that you should no longer do that. And we will try to convince you of that by exploring several areas. First, we will present and search for new biases in the RC4 keystream. Then we will improve plaintext recovery methods, and we will apply these methods to break both WPA TCAP and also to attack HTTPS, where we will try to decrypt a secure cookie. So let's get started with the first part, searching for new biases. I'm first going to introduce a few existing biases, which are quite well known. I think the most famous one is the bias at keystream position 2, where Mountain and Shamir have found that the value 0 is actually twice as likely to occur. And you can even see that these other values in the keystream, they are also clearly not uniform, because if it were uniform, you would see a horizontal line, which is really not the case. And we can do the same thing for the keystream byte 1. And here we see a very strange sine-like graph. And again, we can see that this is clearly not uniform. And we can actually do this for all bytes in the key stream, which was done in previous work. And they basically found that all the initial 256 bytes are non-uniform. Now, these kind of biases where one keystream byte is not uniform generally only occur in the initial keystream bytes, and we call these short-term biases. In contrast, we also have so-called long-term biases that keep occurring throughout whole the keystream. One example was found by Fluer McGrew in 2000, and they found that if you look at consecutive keystream bytes, that certain value pairs occur more often than uniform. For example, the pair 00 and the pair 01, they occur more often than uniform, and that is not what you want. Another well-known bias is the one found by Manton, and it's called the ABSAB bias. And it is also a bias that we will use during our attack. And basically, this bias states that if you have two keystream values that appear in the keystream, these are likely to reappear at some future point in the keystream. So you have two values, you have a gap which can be zero, and then they occur again more often than uniform. And this bias actually decreases in strength if this gap grows larger. So what do we want to do now? We want to search for new biases in the keystream in the hope that we can use them to improve our plaintext recovery techniques. And the traditional empirical method, at least to do this, is to simply generate huge amounts of keystream and then to inspect these in some way. Generally, you can, for example, draw a graph about them and then manually see is there a bias present or not. Unfortunately, this is not ideal if you want to do a large-scale analysis because sometimes you're really looking for a needle in the haystack. For example, if you take the Fluer-McGrew biases as an example, which were actually originally discovered analytically, if you were to do that empirically and manually, you'd have to find that only 8 value pairs, one example being the 00 and the 01, are biased out of a total possible 65,000 pairs. So you're really looking for a needle in a haystack. So we want to automate this. And how do we do that? Well, our solution is to use a hypothesis test. So basically, our null hypothesis will be that there is no bias present, and for example, that the keystream byte is uniformly distributed. And if we then reject the null hypothesis, we know that a bias has been found. And we will actually use this to search for two types of biases. We will first search whether one single keystream byte is not uniformly distributed. And to do this, we use the chi-square test. And we will also look for a second type of bias, and that is to see if two keystream bytes are correlated. And to test for that, we will use the m-test by Fuchs and Kennett. Now, this is a relatively unknown test, but the reason we use this is because it is very good to detect outliers. In other words, this is very good to detect these needles in the haystack that I just mentioned. And using this approach, we were able to do a large-scale search for new biases in the keystream, and we actually found quite a lot of new ones. For example, one of the things we found is that even after position 256 in the keystream, these keystream bytes are still clearly not uniformly distributed. You can see a few other examples here. But I do have to remark that while this graph is not uniform, we have zoomed in quite a bit because if you go at this late position in the keystream, this bias is actually not that strong. So it's not that useful in attacks. Another bias we have found is not a short-term one like this one, but a long-term one that keeps occurring throughout the whole RC4 keystream. And to explain this bias, you have to imagine that the RC4 keystream is basically split up into blocks of 256 bytes. And if you then look at one individual block and you take the first and third keystream byte, you will notice that these are more likely to contain the values 0 and 128. So we've actually found a lot more biases than these. An interesting example is that the first two keystream bytes leak quite a lot of information. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to discuss them all, so if you want to see all the biases, I will have to refer you to the paper. Okay, so now that we have that covered, we will explain how we can use these biases to decrypt plain text. And we will actually use the existing plain text attack of Al-Fardan et al. In 2013, and we will improve that attack. So I'm first going to explain the attack that they used. And essentially what they did is they assumed that the same plain text, which is illustrated here, is encrypted in multiple messages. And what you can do then is you can collect these ciphertext distributions of all these encrypted plain text, essentially. And now the question is, how do we turn this ciphertext distribution into a guess for the plain text? Well, we sort of work the other way around. We're actually first going to guess the value of the plain text, and this induces a certain keystream distribution required to observe these statistics that essentially we captured. And then we try to verify this guess. How do we verify this guess? We compare the induced keystream distribution with the real RC4 distribution that we know. And if they are closely matching, we know that this is very likely the correct plain text. To illustrate this, let's say you have captured the following ciphertext distribution at keystream byte 1. My question is now, which plain text byte is encrypted here? So let's find out. For reference, this is the RC4 keystream distribution at this position. So let's try to guess plain text that the plain text byte is 28 in hex. You can see here in black is the induced keystream distribution if this would have been the plain text byte. And we can clearly see that these two distributions don't really match. So this value has a very high likelihood. On the other hand, if we try a different value, we can see that the match is much better. However, a few points are still off. And finally, if we try the actual plain text byte, we can see that these two distributions are very, very close, and that we actually have the correct plain text byte. So what this previous attack did was basically to pick the plain text value with the highest likelihood. However, this is not always ideal. In practice, it is actually better to have a list of candidates in decreasing likelihood, because this plain text byte with the highest likelihood may actually be the wrong one. And this list of candidates is very useful in practice. For example, sometimes you are trying to decrypt some plain text which has a known structure, and you can actually prune bad candidates. For example, if the plain text you are trying to decrypt has a CRC. And you can also traverse this list to brute force cookies or passwords. So now the question is, how do we generate this list of candidates? I'm only going to present a high-level description of the algorithm, really only the essence of it. And that is that we will use an incremental approach. More specifically, we will first generate all the candidates of length 1, then of length 2, and so on, until we have all the candidates with the desired length. So that is really our first idea to improve these plain text recovery methods. Our second idea is to use the ABSB bias, which is illustrated here again as a reference. And we will abuse this bias by assuming there is actually known plain text at one of these sites. So at one site, we know the plain text that was encrypted here, and the other site, we don't know the plain text, and we want to try to get a likelihood estimate of this plain text. So what we will do is we will actually abuse the plain text here to derive the keystream values A and B, and then we rely on the Mantin's ABSAB bias to probabilistically predict the keystream byte values A prime on B prime. So essentially, we are actually using the surrounding known plaintext to simply reduce this bias to a bias over only 2 bytes. And if we do this, again, without going into too much detail, we can basically do the same likelihood calculations as I explained previously, and we can come up with a likelihood estimate of the plaintext bytes at A prime and B prime. So the formula you saw in my overview slide, that is actually the one that we use here. However, the details on the meaning of these variables is not important. What is important is that if we want to abuse this bias, we have to rely on surrounding known plain text. So That were the two methods to improve plaintext recovery. We are now going to apply them to break WPA TKIP. So first, a quick introduction on WPA TKIP. Let's say that you are a client and want to transmit data to an access point. The first thing that this protocol does is append a message integrity check, and then it also appends a CRC. The CRC is actually useless. It doesn't really serve a purpose. However, it had to be included to be able to run the WPA TKIP protocol on old web-compatible hardware. And finally, an initialization vector is also prepended to the packet. This is basically to prevent replay attacks and is increased by one for every frame. And finally, the packet is encrypted using RC4 with a per-packet key. And this per-packet key is always unique. And that actually brings me to the first vulnerability in WPA TKIP, and that is the construction of this per-packet key. So how is this per-packet key constructed? Well, we take the shared key between the client and the access point. We also take the sender MAC address and the initialization vector. We mix these values, and then we get a per-packet key. However, what the designers of WPA TKIP did then is they override these first three values of the key. And the reason they do this is in an attempt to avoid so-called weak keys which broke web. However, this actually has the opposite effect. It doesn't increase the strength, it actually weakens it. And why is that? That is because this initialization vector is publicly known, so an attacker knows these values, which in turn means that the attacker also knows the first two three bytes of the per packet key. And it has been shown in previous works that knowing these first three bytes of the packet key can actually be used to improve the attacks because they induce IV-dependent biases into the keystream. So that is the first flaw we will abuse. The second flaw in WPA TKIP is that this message integrity code is rather weak. And what I mean with that is if you're able to obtain the decrypted data on the MIC field, you can actually very efficiently reverse the algorithm and reveal the MIC key. And this is exactly what we will try to do in our attack. We will try to, by the way, if you have this MIC key, we have shown in previous work that this MIC key alone is sufficient to inject and decrypt a few packets. So as I was saying, our goal is now to decrypt both the data and the MIC field using these RC4 biases. Now, as I explained previously, in order to execute these attacks, we need to repeatedly encrypt the exact same plaintext, which here means we will need to generate identical packets, because if even just one bit in this packet changes, then also the message integrity code will also completely change, and the CRC code will also change, and that is not what we want. So how can we inject identical packets into a wireless network? Well, we basically assume that the victim somehow connects to a malicious server under control of the attacker. This can be done using social engineering or vulnerabilities in some kind of web application. There are quite a lot of possibilities. And what the attacker can then do is once a TCP connection is opened to his server, is basically constantly retransmit the same TCP packet. And because TCP retransmissions are a valid protocol behavior, this would also not be blocked by a firewall which could be near the victim. So once we have captured all these injected packets, we can use our IV-dependent biases to construct a list of plaintext candidates. So essentially, we are generating candidates for the data and MIC field and also for the CRC field. And we can then actually prune bad candidates by recalculating the CRC ourselves and checking is it correct or not. And this quite drastically improves the probability of correctly decrypting whole this part. So we have done simulations to see how well this works. And if we generate around 2 to the power 30 candidates, you will see that we only need to encrypt roughly 2 to the power 24 packets to be able to correctly decrypt this packet and then derive the MIC key. So if we then try to do the execute this in practice, we can see that at least in our setup, we can generate 2,500 packets per second, meaning we can actually execute this attack within only 1 hour. And we actually try to execute this attack in our lab, and everything worked, and we successfully recovered the MIC key. So we have a sort of broken WPA TKIP, and now let's move on to breaking HTTPS. So first and for all, a very quick introduction to TLS. Basically, you first have a handshake protocol, which negotiates the key to be used. And then we have the record protocol, which will actually encrypt our data. We will focus on the record protocol, assuming that RC4 has been selected as a cipher. So what previous attacks basically did is they used the plaintext recovery techniques that I explained previously, and they only used the Fluor-McGrew biases in order to perform these attacks. We extend these attacks by using also the ABSAB biases and also again generating a list of candidates. The requirement to use this ABSAB bias, as I previously mentioned, is that the plaintext we are targeting must be surrounded by known plaintext which we can predict. And how do we do that? Well, we want to decrypt this cookie, so the other unknown cookies around this cookie that we want to decrypt have to be removed, and then we inject other cookies around it, so this the authentication cookie is completely surrounded by known plaintext. To illustrate this, let's say you have the following HTTP request. Here you have the cookie that we want to target. As you can see, the surrounding cookies that were unknown has been removed. There are no question marks. We have injected a cookie to assure that it is surrounded by known plaintext at both sides. And even these headers in front of the HTTP request, these are quite predictable. So now the question is, how do we actually manipulate these secure cookies? How can we remove them? Well, we can't remove them if the client uses a HTTPS connection, because that's still quite secure and we can mess with it. However, if we can induce the victim into connecting to a subdomain which does not use HTTPS, we can actually manipulate these secure cookies over this insecure connection. In particular, we can remove and inject secure cookies. So, with this preparation done, so the HTTP request of the victim is now in this layout, we can actually execute the attack. So the first thing we will do is, when the victim visits any unencrypted website, we will use our man-in-the-middle position to inject a JavaScript code into this website. And what will that JavaScript code do? It will generate a very high number of requests in order to, so we can actually capture enough ciphertext, essentially. And when we simply monitor that ciphertext request, it is actually very important that these connections that the client uses rely on a keep alive connection. And this is because otherwise a new TLS collection would be created for every single request that is made. And the overhead of the handshake in TLS would really slow down the attack. So it's important that one connection is used to basically transmit multiple HTTPS requests so we can generate enough traffic fast enough. And finally, we will use our plaintext recovery technique to generate a list of candidates for this cookie. And we basically brute force the cookie based on this list. So if we simulate this attack and we try to brute force the cookie using at most 2 to the power 23 candidates, we will see that we have quite high success rates. Once we are at position, once we have roughly it's 2 to the power 31 keystreams, you can see then we have more than 90% success rate. On the other hand, if we had only used one candidate, so if we wouldn't be brute forcing the cookie, at this point we would only be at around a success rate of 20%. So really generating this list of candidates really pays off. Okay, I'm going to show a quick demo of how this works. So first, the attacker is going to use its man in the middle position to monitor traffic. And you have to imagine that this is the website that the user visits, which contains the malicious JavaScript code. And if we execute that, we can see that our man in the middle position is indeed working. And in this case, I am executing the attack against a VM, so the network is very fast, and we get a very high amount of requests per second. So now we're going to pretend that we executed this attack for around 70 hours, and then we can actually try to brute force the cookie. So hopefully this will work. It's actually now probably loading this data, or something is going wrong. But this file is actually 215 megabytes, so it might take a while. Though normally it shouldn't take this long. Ah, I know, I'm still generating the plain text, which really slows down everything. So normally it should go faster now. And if that doesn't work, you can also always visit the website RC4 No More, where I actually recorded a demo of this in case of a backup. You can see it is working, it's just taking a while. Now, as you can see, it's generating all the candidates, and now it's traversing this candidate list, and it's trying each individual cookie. And when it finds the correct cookie, it will notify the user, and indeed, we have the correct cookie. So the attack succeeded. So if you are going to try to replicate this attack or execute it yourself, may the bias be ever in your favor. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
All right, if nobody else is going to ask questions, I will take the 2 minutes that we have for questions to ask one. So Snowden himself and several people who have seen the leaked NSA documents have said very clearly that they think that government agencies are decrypting RC4 in real time. And the attacks that you've presented and other papers require a large number of plain texts. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas for what these other people might be doing?
Well, I think if you're going to continue this approach, you probably can improve it a little bit, but to do it real time, at least in the manner we did, is not going to be possible. So I don't know, my guess might be that they're trying to recover the internal state. On the other hand, the internal state of RC4 is huge, so I don't have any idea how they're doing it. I'm actually a little bit skeptical about those remarks. I think they have better attacks, but it would still be quite impressive if they really can do it real time.
Thank you, it's very impressive. So if nobody else has any more questions, let's thank the speaker again.